Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens, below the line, with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, sound mixers, the VFX gurus, composers, you name it, we talk to them. And I'm happy to be back this week. Last week, it was my intention to be here, but hit with a bout of food poisoning on Sunday night, which does not make for driving an hour and a half to the studio and being on air on a Monday morning. So we, of course, last week, we reran our episode that featured R.J. Collins, director of Crescent City, and Emmy-nominated Blake Neely, talking Masters of the Air. So, but today, got a full show for you here. Midpoint of the show, director Simon Boisvert is joining us live to talk about his new film, Charlie Tango, which opens on September the 3rd. It's a fun thriller. It's got a lot of twists and turns, so I can't wait to speak with Simon about that one. It shocked even me with how the film plays out. But first, very excited. I want to tell y'all, we've got some really great films that are opening this week on the 30th. One of them is Reagan, directed by the wonderful Sean McNamara, starring Dennis Quaid as Ronald Reagan. It is a wonderful, wonderful film. So well done. I spoke with Sean at length. That interview will be up on BehindTheLensOnline.net this week. Also, The Thicket is coming, directed by Elliot Lester. I love Elliot. We first met back in 2014 at LA Film Festival for his film Nightingale, starring David Oyelowo. And then after that, we were on a roll. He was directing Chop Shop with the other guys at Bandito Brothers, and then Aftermath, and then we kind of lost touch. Well, we've now reconnected over his vision of the latest of the adaptation of Joe R. Lansdale's book, The Thicket. It is phenomenal. Phenomenal. Juliette Lewis is in it, and she is award-worthy. But that, you can also hear that interview this week on BehindTheLensOnline.net. And a few other films, are one of which, You Love Baseball, World Series, Little League World Series. All you fans, Little League fans out there, think back to 2002. And the West Side All-Stars from Fort Worth, Texas. How they went on to the Little League World Series in Williamsport. They played the longest game still on record in history for the Little League World Series. It was televised on ESPN. I remember watching it live, as do I'm sure many of you. Well, Ty Roberts has now made this into a film that is so heartwarming. And because it is a true story, it's not divulging any spoilers or anything. But their coach, who in the film is played by Luke Wilson, was dying of cancer and was undergoing treatment at the time of this. There are a lot of really poignant moments there. These are all kid actors with no acting experience. They are fantastic. And my interview with Ty, and you've heard Ty. Ty's been on the show before a couple of times. Once with his film, The Iron Orchard, while it was still on the fest circuit. And he called in from a festival floor to talk about the film with his co-writer and some of his other crew. So three great films that are going to be hitting you at the end of this week. But right now, we're going to talk about a film that I am in love with. It is hilarious. It is called The Cleanup Crew. It is directed by John Keyes. And John, he is probably best known as a producer of things like Boneyard. And you just heard my exclusive interview with writer-director Asif Akbar last month about that. The Kill Room that starred Samuel Jackson, Joe Manganiello, Uma Thurman, Reverse the Curse, Paradise City, Codename Banshee, Gasoline Alley, one of the last films of Bruce Willis before his retirement. This film, written by Matthew Rogers, who also wrote Codename Banshee and The Survivalist, which John directed. But this one, The Cleanup Crew, it is hysterical. It stars Melissa Leo in a balls-to-the-wall performance. Who knew Melissa could be this hilarious? Antonio Banderas, who steals every scene he's in. Sven Temel, Ekaterina Baker, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Simple premise. Crime scene cleanup crew, which is Jonathan Rhys-Meyers' character of Alex, Ekaterina's character of Megan, Sven Temel's character of Chuck, and Melissa Leo's character of Siobhan. This is their job. They do crime scene, you know, in other words, murder scenes, crime scene cleanup. And while they are there at this one, it turns out it was a safe house. And things go wrong during a pizza delivery to the safe house. There are dead bodies and blood everywhere. The cleanup crew comes in, and then they find a briefcase full of money shoved up the chimney. So, you've got the criminal kingpin, Antonio Banderas. He wants his money because he's indebted to some corrupt cops and FBI guys. So, this goes, it just is hilarious. Hilarious. As we go through here with the mobster setup of payment not being delivered, the wheels, it puts everything in motion. But of course, the cleanup crew, when they open the suitcase and they see what's in there, some of them don't want to give it back. Then there are things that happen to them. They've got to negotiate. And it is just so funny. Working with editor Rylan Rafferty, everything keeps moving back and forth. We are right there in concurrent timelines. The editing is crisp, but you know, you don't get confused or convoluted. Cinematography by Austin Schmidt. Very polished color saturation. Absolutely wonderful. Dialogue is quick. It's witty. There are some wonderful montages, one of which is actually, it's called Moving Up the Food Chain. And it is hilarious. But this is the kind of film you can just sit back, watch, and have a damn good time with it. So instead of me prattling on any further, I may break this about, because it's a long interview. So I may break this when Simon calls in and then finish up John's interview as the tail end of the show. But we'll see what happens. So, but I will let you hear all the fun and hilarity that John Keyes and I had in our exclusive interview talking about the cleanup crew.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm so happy to be speaking with you. You have been one of the forces as a producer, co-producer, director, behind some really delightful, delicious films. Boneyard being one of them, which I love. I just talked to R.J. Collins the other day.
Yeah, oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, that was a, we just, I guess, what, it's been about a year, a little over a year ago that I produced that one. That was a whole lot of fun making that in Las Vegas.
It is such a good film, and I'm glad that you guys really put your faith in Asif. He really did a great job with that one. But, you know, then you're also behind, like, Paradise City, Reverse the Curse, Gasoline Alley, which I absolutely loved. That was one of Willis's final films in that slew, and he really did a great job in that one. But then you directing Codename Banshee and Rogue Hostage. I love the pairing of Tyrese and Malkovich in that one. You have kept me entertained.
That's my whole purpose in life. That's all I want to do is be able to entertain.
And you do a good job of it. And you do it again with the cleanup crew. This film is so much fun. From beginning to end, you kick us off with opening titles that really set the tone of batshit craziness from the beginning.
It was funny was when we were, just actually talking about those titles quickly. There's a company out in the Carolinas called Out of Our Mind, and I've worked with them in various capacities for years. And it seems some stuff that they've been doing, and I was talking to my producing partner, Richard Claybaugh, and I was like, it would be so much fun to have them do this really kind of crazy, fun title sequence that people wouldn't be expecting, that would kind of set a tone. And so, I mean, even that alone, being able to work that into the movie, was as much fun as making the movie as well. I mean, everything about making that movie was just fun. And I had not done that much comedy. And so when I got the script, and, there was this beautiful balance of action and comedy mm-hmm. into it, I was like, oh boy, we just have to go full tilt boogie with this and have a whole lot of fun. And hopefully the audience jumps on board with that entertainment.
The whole thing is balls to the wall. And, as I said, with the opening titles, I mean, you really, they're batshit crazy. I mean, they're neon, they're vibrant, they're graphic. There's a lot of Saul Bass influence in there, but then pushed
absolutely
to the nth degree. And for me, and I've been speaking with a few, over the past like 10 days, I've been speaking with some of the Emmy-nominated main title creatives. And that's one of the things that impresses me and that some people don't get is that you've got to catch the audience right away. And when you can have a main title design, such as what you have here, such as what some of this year's Emmy nominees have, it catches the eye, but it also is really a synopsis of the entire film.
Exactly, exactly. Well, and it's so important, particularly when we were setting up the cleanup crew, because I know that in a lot of ways it's going to get marketed as an action movie, and it is, obviously. But, I didn't want the comedy, the zaniness of the movie to kind of get lost as well for the audience. So we wanted to make sure between how we opened the movie, how we set the tone with the ending, set the tone with the title, so the audience know in the first 3 to 5 minutes exactly what kind of movie this is going to be.
Yeah, and there is no question about it, John. No question. We get past the titles, and then we've got Antonio Banderas, who is, he's hysterical, he's a scene stealer. He brings a lot of his Galgo character from Expendables into Gabriel, the way he's nonstop chatter, 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 and very fastidious in his movement and his fingers and his hands and how he dresses. But you've got a whole cleanup crew, and all they do is go to death scenes, murder scenes, and do hazmat cleanup. That right there, if you're not going to laugh at this, you got a problem.
Exactly. Well, and it's funny is I've had this idea literally floating in my head for 25 years. All the way back to before I actually directed my first movie, this was an idea that's been floating around about this cleanup crew, homicide cleanup crew that gets, that gets caught in the middle of a big crime family, and a whole deal that's going on and have to figure their way out. But I always knew that I never wanted to do it seriously. It is a serious movie. I wanted it to be somewhat, comedy. And Matthew Rogers, who wrote the script, he had written Codename Banshee, the survivalist for me.
Yep.
And I was like, and Matthew loves comedy. He loves to write comedy, even though what he's written has been more just straightforward action. And I told him this nugget of an idea. And I have it a little bit more mapped out in my head, but I just gave him this, 30-second pitch, and he's like, don't say anything else. he's like, let me just run with it. And what he brought back was just, it was phenomenal. I was like, this is just so fun. And my director of photography and I, he and I go way back, was in a lot of movies together, and,
yeah.
and I shared it with him immediately. We're incredibly collaborative, and just the three of us, Austin, myself, and Matthew, huddled together endlessly, you know, playing with it, refining it, and figuring out the tone of the movie, and figuring out all the sort of the crazy editing and the split frames, and, you know, and we just kind of fed off of each other creatively. Matthew was with us in Ireland when we were filming it, so we were all constantly feeding off each other just to pour more into it.
Your setup really starts. We've got Gabriel, we meet Gabriel, we've got our cleaning crew, or our cleanup crew, as you will. But when you have a shootout that involves pizza in a safe house, when I sent my lengthy initial thoughts to them on the film, I put in there, the shootout involving pizza at the safe house made me guffaw. And that was, I mean, it really, that was it, a guffaw. It was so funny. And this is where Austin's work really starts to kick in, giving us some of those great shots of people looking up the chimney, shoving a suitcase in there. But the setup is so good. And fortunately, Matthew's script runs with it. It's not, this isn't one of those cases where we get a great setup and it's, okay, how fast can we get to the end because the middle really sucks? That is not what happens here. The story is solid. The characters are to die for, especially Siobhan, what Melissa Leo brings. Never in a million years would I have thought of Melissa for that role. She is kick-ass, batshit brilliant.
And it was funny. It was Melissa. I had worked with, not as a director, but as a producer. I had worked with Melissa once before. And when everybody started batting around ideas of who to play Siobhan, I'm like, Melissa. And everybody's like, oh, that's an interesting idea. And so Melissa got the script, and her and I spent several hours on a Zoom together just kind of going through it. And we were on the same page of who Siobhan was and how she would be and how she would sort of, you know, she was a catalyst for a lot of events, but
yeah.
she was also sort of a grounding point for a lot of the characters. And we had Melissa and I bonded, everybody. It was just one of the most incredible bonding experiences between myself and a group of actors and a crew to just come together uniformly and feed off of each other and make everything that each of us did as individuals stronger and better for the whole collective.
As I watch Melissa, besides being hilarious, it's that blend, that nonchalant, no-nonsense, call it like she sees it, but all done with snark. And
exactly.
It just, step on dead bodies, don't step on dead bodies, look and say, oh, now we got to clean that up. And then you put her with Sven Temmels, Chuck. That bond of those two is so hilarious. It is so good.
Their chemistry, they had not met together. They had not met before until we were all together in Ireland.
Oh.
The two of them just hit it immediately, you know, right out of the gate. And they were feeding off each other. And they were there. Everybody was there for a week before we started filming. So they, you know, we did table reads together. We did a little bit of rehearsing together. I don't do a lot of rehearsing, but we just did a little bit. And I gave them all of the nuggets of the relationship and of the characters. And then they went off by themselves and spent several days spending time with each other, not necessarily even like line reading the scripts with each other, but just playing with who Siobhan and Chuck are and what their background is and learning how to riff off of each other and play off of each other. So by the time we started filming, they had developed that innate relationship that we see between the two of them in the movie.
Well, this is one of the things that you and your teams are always so good at in the films that you produce and you direct. You have this great gift for putting together, at times it may seem like the most disparate group of people in an ensemble, but But it works, much like in Boneyard. You would not expect that ensemble to work at first blush, especially when you find out who the characters are and what they portray. You would not expect Mel Gibson in that bunch.
Yep, exactly. But he blended in seamlessly.
He did. And the same thing here with Cleanup Crew. You would not expect to see Melissa and Jonathan and then Ekaterina and Swen and then Antonio Banderas icing on the cake there for our five main principals. You would not think of this ensemble, but particularly the four, our core Cleanup Crew, with Melissa, Swen, Ekaterina, and Jonathan. But it works. You have this gift that you can see what is going to work with the chemistry of your cast.
I thank you for that. I appreciate that. And that's something that, I mean, obviously, so many directors say 90% of their job is casting. And, you know, and Matthew did that, made my job so much easier because the characters they play on film are the characters that are on the page. He had fleshed them out, and we developed the dynamics and the unique personalities with each of them and how to definitely play off of each other to keep the momentum of the story going and the arcs going. And so he made it very easy to then visualize and see who would work, what kind of personality would work within each of these. And then you put the four of them in the room together, and they just all had fun. And they were so great at ripping off of each other.
And you can see that. With the very first cleanup at the pizza house, the pizza safe house, as I will call it, they walk in and it's like, oh, hell, look at this. And some get into it. And the whole time you've got Ekaterina's character, Megan. All she wants to do is get money, leave the cleaning business, and open a funeral parlor. Matthew is very gifted in fleshing out his characters on paper, because if they were not this fleshed out, I don't think we would have the synergy and the cohesiveness that we have on screen, or the hilarity.
100%. I totally agree with you. Well, and that's one of the beauties, one of the things I love as a director and working with actors, is if the character's not fleshed out on the paper, then they're spending most of their time just trying to figure the character out.
Yeah.
Whereas if you give them a fully rounded, fleshed out character on paper, they can get it immediately, and then they can actually spend their time and their energy and their focus on elevating it above what's on the paper in a free-form, creative way with no struggle. It just gives them the freedom to then become and embrace those characters and take it further than you thought they could.
Well, and especially when we're dealing with an independent film, like the films you make, like the Cleanup Crew, you don't have the luxury of a big tent pole where you've got $300 million at your disposal so that actors can come in and take all the time in the world to find their character. You got to come in and hit the ground running on something like this.
Well, what was even really fascinating for me watching them work, it's because we were actually shooting two movies back to back. We shot Cult Killer and Cleanup Crew back to back, and like literally at the same time. And Antonio was in both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew Tompkins, who played Rob, was in both of those. And we set it up so we shot the two movies next to each other. But then we brought Antonio in to shoot all of his stuff for one movie and then all of his stuff for the other. So not only did they get to play with these and hit the ground running, they were doing that while juggling two characters in two movies at the same time.
Wow.
Which was even more spectacular to watch.
And Antonio's, it's not a tiny part. He's got some very significant scenes and some very significant monologues.
Absolutely. And Antonio even, like, you know, talked to me, and he's like, this is probably the most talking I've done in movies in a very long time.
Yeah. he normally gets to come in and just look menacing or handsome or both. But, yeah, he's got a lot of dialogue here.
Well, he's such a brilliant actor. He's one of those gifts that you get as a director who can take a piece of dialogue, because he didn't change his dialogue. His dialogue is what's in the script. But, you know, he's just so gifted to be able to understand the nuances of dialogue and the nuance of performance that he can take exactly what's on the paper and put spins on it and adjustments on it and pronunciations, you know, in specific spots that change the dynamic of it. And he's just so naturally funny that he got to really play with this and become a zany without becoming over the top.
He does an amazing, amazing job. And he is a scene stealer.
Absolutely.
Richly textured, egomaniacal. I love the fact he quotes Machiavelli. And then covering all of that is the incredible costume design Ferdia Murphy gives him, or Gemma gives him, dressing him all in the blues and the fabric of the suits and the precision, very bespoke, very perfect, with buttons and little chains and accoutrement that really set it off. And color is, this leads me to color in this film. Color is so important here with what you've done. Everything blue is relegated to Gabriel. The rest of the film, you're really focusing on reds, greens, yellows, and the reddish-orange jumpsuits. And metaphorically, it's stop-go caution through the entire film.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it was fun for Austin and I because so many of the movies we've done have been darker movies, you know, desaturated, lots of grays and tones and stuff. And so just, you know, we made that decision to go big, bright, and brilliant, you know, with this. And even if you kind of play with the idea of like what you just said, you know, Antonio wearing the blues, Antonio wearing some darker green, the colors of his office, we don't even have that sort of the trope of the black represents the bad guy, white represents the good guy type of scenario. But we just simply did it with shade rather than color. So we were able to keep everything colorful and still, you know, and just blow everything out with such bright colors. That was really fun for me because I hadn't been able to do that before.
And here again, this goes back to your main titles and the use of neons and the colors that explode in your main titles. We see it pop up through this production design, through the costuming, through your color palette throughout the film. So it's very, this is so well thought out, John, and put together.
Thank you.
Got to talk about what you and Austin have done, though. Polished, saturated color. You've got some great dutching happening here. You keep us pretty much in two shots or mid-two shots for the most part because you break down your core of four generally into a two and two scenario.
Yep.
But I got to tell you, where Austin just blew me away is in the ding-dong ditch sequence, which Jonathan just plays to the hill at the front door. But then when Sven's character of Chuck comes out, we're in John Wick mode with a 360. And Austin's got the camera going around the 360. Just unexpected, a pure joy to see. And it's in slow-mo. Hello.
We had so much fun, and Sven had so much fun. I mean, we took a lot of rehearsing, a lot of practice to get the timings right, because, of course, we've got all the different bad guys in the circle outside of him that were rotating through and seeing behind him. But that was one, like, from the get-go, one of the first things Austin came up with when he was reading the script is, we've got to do this. We absolutely have to do this. And so being able to shoot it that way was so much fun. And for the way that Chuck is able to go from his sort of nonchalant, lackadaisical, don't really care about anything, into pure gunfighter mode, and then sort of back into his normal personality again. The transition Sven was able to do with that between Austin's camera and his performance made it so fun.
Oh, absolutely. And then you have all these great puzzle pieces. Then it falls on Ryland to edit this together. And I have to tell you, the editing is so crisp. This is so good. Taking us back and forth between the action setups and the groupings of the talent. Keeping us aware. We know at all times what each is doing within the timeline of this story. Gabriel and his guys, a corrupt cop, Alex and Chuck. Eventually, Siobhan comes wandering in there. It's sharp. It's quick. The pacing matches the dialogue and the dialogue delivery and the wit. Just incredible. And then you give us a montage that is to die for, the moving up the food chain montage.
Which was so fun. And those were, I mean, we had the montage, we knew the montage was going to happen, but we were literally just sort of, I mean, because Matthew was with us also, we were making the montages up as we went, because we put them later in the schedule so that we could kind of get the vibe and the rhythm of the movie going and stuff. And then we would just like, hey, today let's pick up this piece of montage. And some of them were scripted, some of them we made up, but it was so fun. And then just to be able to get the song that went with it was so amazing to be able to edit to.
I fell in love. That sequence is just so, so much fun. But how challenging was the edit of this? Because with all these moving parts, the fact that you're trying to keep us informed as to the different pockets of what's happening, keep us in the timeline, and keep the film moving without dropping the ball.
It was definitely challenging. And I don't want to say it was challenging in a bad way. I mean, we knew going into it that it was going to be a challenging edit, particularly because of some of the editing styles, because of the multiple split frames floating around with each other and the 360s and, you know, just some of the different stuff we did with the camera and how we were going to kind of stylize it. We knew that those were going to be a challenge. Assembling the story and putting the story together, we had that really worked out before we shot it. So for Rylan, that was pretty easy, and she had a great gift with the personalities and the storytelling. We, you know, most of the time was actually spent on those different stylized pieces, the montage, the shootout at the cabin with the split frames. That's where we spent a long time, because there were so many choices of how we could do it and what we would use. And so, I mean, I would say, 70% of our time in the edit was actually spent on those, reworking them until we were absolutely happy with them.
Just so well done. I kept waiting for some ball to drop, and it didn't. It really didn't.
Thank you.
And then on top of this, you've got this great score. It is very whimsical. It's got shades. It reminded me of Knives Out, a very Knives Out.
Okay, so I'm going to hold John's interview right there, and we'll pick it up after. We'll pick that up at the end of the show to finish that up, talking about the score and a few miscellaneous pieces. But right now, I am thrilled to welcome Simon Boisvert talking about Charlie Tango. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Debbie Lynn.
How are you?
I'm doing great. It's fun when a new movie's coming out.
Oh, and this is a good movie. You blew me away. You've got twists and turns in here that I did not see coming, especially your ultimate one, which we're not going to reveal. But let me just tell all the listeners that come September 3rd, you want to watch Charlie Tango, and you definitely want to sit there to the very end, because it's really fun. There you are, Simon.
Yeah, we got disconnected.
Oh, my goodness. Just as I'm telling everybody, they've got to watch the film and watch it to the end on September 3rd.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is such... I love this blend that you have going on here. We've got a situation where our main protagonist, Kim, she's an air traffic controller who works at night. She also is, you can tell, she's got a wild side to her. She sings rock and roll, not karaoke, actually with a band backing and everything. She does that part-time. She's married. has a very nice home, but she's also got a little something-something on the side. And then we have a tragedy happen while she's working at night as an air traffic controller. And everything just spirals as we're discovering what happened that went so wrong, then what's happening with how she's dealing with grief and the things that she takes. You've really melded a lot here, Simon. So I'm curious what led you to this story and how you developed it and the different emotional beats that it takes.
Well, what happened at first is that many, many years ago, I had two scripts. One of them was about the air traffic control accident that mm-hmm. we see in the movie
right.
with Kim. But I also had a script about a guy who was running a Ponzi scheme. But in both cases, I did not have enough material to have two complete feature films.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to myself, how do I combine both and make it work? Because I needed to intertwine the two stories.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, I had the idea of making her, you know, her life is spiraling down.
Yeah.
And I said, well, why not make it spiral down with the lover
mm-hmm.
who is running a Ponzi scheme?
And I think...
And that's how I was able to connect the two stories and make a feature film out of two stories that are really, really connected, as you can see as the film goes on.
Absolutely. And I think it's brilliant the way that you have merged and melded the two different stories, because when you're dealing with an emotional crisis such as what Kim is dealing with, you aren't going to be thinking clearly, and you're going to do things. You don't want to deal with the grief. You don't want to deal with the fallout. You don't want to deal with the possible repercussions, and you try and escape. And it's like, well, okay, well, maybe I'll just rebuild my whole life. And then it's, oh, God, I'm going to need a lawyer, and I need money. So what better than to jump on board with this guy I'm already screwing around with and go into business with him. So it works. From an emotional standpoint, you take us through the stages of grief and responsibility or lack thereof, processing disaster, personal crisis, and you really build this up. It's very plausible, and you've already established the fact that, you know, she does have this music side of her, this wild side of her, so that you can believe her making rash decisions. So
exactly.
I love how you have established that and set that up, because it's once she starts working with Charlie, who is beautifully played as a skeevy snake oil salesman kind of guy by David LaHaye. He's wonderful in the role. Everything starts snowballing. But we believe everything that's happening. As the whole, instead of resolving any problems, the apple cart gets upset even more. I love your construct. I love the story construct, Simon.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, the idea was to show from the start that she had a rock and roll life, not only because she sings rock and roll, but, you know, in the sense that she has a very, very wild life.
Yes.
Although she has a very serious job. So I like to show people sometimes who have a serious side and a wild side,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes you don't expect that. Some people with very high-paying jobs can actually have a double life,
mm-hmm.
if I may say.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's in her early 50s, I think, was interesting. And also a woman doing what is traditionally considered a man's job. which is air traffic controller. There's more and more women doing it, but it's still a minority. And I figured that, you know, she also likes to do rock and roll, like some hard rock stuff that she probably grew up liking, you know, in the 80s and 90s.
Uh-huh.
And to me, it was interesting to show that 50-somethings, and especially women, are not just going to have play characters like the mother, the auntie, even the grandma.
Yes.
And that's why this is a part that could have been given to a 30-year-old actress, but I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to show that, you know, life doesn't end at 40 or 50.
Yeah, and of course, you know, everybody it talks about a midlife crisis, and generally they attribute that to men, but that happens to women as equally as it happens to men. So you could attribute part of, you know, it just all falls in so beautifully based on the way you've constructed this and the character in her life. And then adding to the mix, her husband is a cop. So that
makes it interesting.
That really makes it interesting on multiple levels. And I don't want to give away too much about this and how all of this impacts the other and where it goes. But needless to say, the husband is not stupid.
No, I actually, he's probably the type of character that most people will be rooting for throughout the film.
Yeah.
Whereas in her case, at first, I'm not sure people will be rooting for her, but I think at some point they will. As for the villain that she's fooling around with, I think he is what he is, the villain.
Yeah, that's exactly.
So it's, I thought it was interesting, a threesome of characters.
Very much so. Very much so. And then you get some great peripheral characters. Diana Lewis is Tonya, who is essentially a lackey for Charlie. And then Marcel Janine as Bob, who is an ally to Jeff and ostensibly to Kim. But really, it's a small cast. You keep it contained. Now, once you have this on paper, and the sets, you don't have a lot of sets. So you really kept your footprint small. How did you go about translating this to the screen? You bring in a wonderful cinematographer, Alexandre Bussier. I love what he did on Montreal Girls with Patricia Chica a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And so his work is wonderful. You keep everything clean, light, bright, which is really interesting because of the darkness that Kim is dealing with and the darkness of the events that are unfolding. But you keep the visual tonal bandwidth very light, very bright. You play to the windows in Charlie's offices. You play to the white and the windows in Jeff and Kim's house. So we never get bogged down. You give us a clarity with that light visual tonal bandwidth. So I'm curious about what you and Alexandra were thinking and what you were cooking up when you were plotting this.
Yeah, that's an interesting question because it's a movie that could have gone down very, like, the dark road, let's call it.
Yes.
And we didn't want to do some dark, depressing movie, although the topic at first is very depressing with the plane crash. We wanted to keep it, first of all, we wanted to do a mainstream movie, something that most people will enjoy as pure entertainment. And therefore, I didn't want to fall into I didn't want the character to fall into some kind of depression
mm-hmm.
that would make the audience feel all this.
Right.
I wanted to show someone who's a fighter, someone who wants to get her life back together, although she doesn't always make good choices. So that was the reason behind the cinematography. It was to show that there's light at the end of the tunnel, and she's not just a depressed person.
Yeah, I love that the two of you went that route in your visual design and with your visual grammar. You keep your camera shots clean, two shots for the most part. You avoid close-ups, extreme close-ups. You've got a few close-ups, but nothing is really so not an extreme close-up. So it's easy to look at, it's easy to watch, and it's unfettered so that you can pay attention to the characters and the story, because twists and turns keep coming here, Simon.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I take the audience north, and basically they're going south, and then I take them east, and they're going west.
Yeah.
Throughout the movie, especially the last, I would say 45 minutes.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, that was the goal. You're mentioning the two shots. I like to see like the reaction of both characters when
yes.
they talk. So that's why we had two shots. As for the close-ups, you don't want too many, because otherwise you become more like an afternoon soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to pick and choose them at the right moment. So we had a few, but very few. And it was interesting to see all characters interact, like at the bar when Charlie is talking to Bob. A lot of it is the two shot, because
yeah.
While one is talking, you can see how the other one is reacting.
Yeah.
So that was the idea. Yeah.
With a story like this, Simon, it really helps the story when we're not doing coverage shots and cutting back and forth. That two shot really helps us as an audience, and it helps your story. And I'm so glad that you and Alexandra did that, to shoot it that way, so that we know what's going on. And even in the police station, where Jeff is talking to his boss and to his colleague, you keep all three of them on camera. All three of them are there.
Yeah, we have some individual shots here and there.
Yeah.
But most of the time, yeah, we do see the three of them interact, because I think it's important to see the reaction shots of each character as basically Jeff is defending himself. I mean, I don't think I'm selling too much by saying this.
No.
It's just the conversation between a boss and two employees, yeah.
And plus the fact that they are police, they are colleagues, they work as a team. So it makes perfect sense. You would want to see them. It's like if you look back at old television episodes of Adam 12, and we've always got Reed and Malloy, they're in the car together. We've got a frontal shot of the two of them talking in the car, or they're together when they're out on the street or handling a situation, because they are a team. They work as one, and that's essentially what the feeling that we get here. Is that the boss may be a little disgruntled with Jeff about something, but they're still a team. They're still a unit. And that really needs to come through, and it does. Really good. Smartly done on your part, Simon. Smartly
Thank
done.
You. Thank you.
Now, of course, you bring in a wonderful editor, Matthew Bellinger. He cut Piece by Chocolate for Jonathan Kaiser. And did a beautiful job with that. He does a beautiful job here. How challenging was the edit here? Because you're balancing the drama that initially sets in with this air traffic control incident. Then we've got emotional drama, and it turns into a whole crime thriller, crime mystery thriller. So those are really edgy beats that you've got to hit. So I'm curious how challenging the edit was for you and Matthew.
Well, first of all, we had about the first cut was about 2 hours long, and the movie ends up being an hour and 38 or 39 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So we cut approximately 20 to 25 minutes.
That's a lot.
What we did, we deleted some scenes, and we cut some dialogue even within scenes, because what we did after we got it down to maybe an hour and 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. We went line by line and always asking ourselves, line by line, is this making the story move forward? Because in this day and age, you don't want, especially for a thriller, you don't want the story to stall. People necessarily don't have the same attention span as they used to. Mm-hmm. So you have to make them embark very quickly in a film, and then you have to keep them engaged throughout the film. So we tried to delete everything that wasn't really necessary to make the story well understood. So that's why, especially the second half, is quite fast-paced, and things happen very quickly. So that was the thing. The biggest challenge was obviously the air traffic control scene. Mm-hmm. Trying to make it work between the cockpit and the outside shots of the plane and the air traffic control center. Mm-hmm. So that was a tough one to put together because I think it's a 5 or 6 minute long scene and it's very crucial.
Yeah.
And when I took it to festivals, I saw people who were like putting their hand in front of their eyes because at some point, there are times where they couldn't watch because it was so nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
So that's when I realized that we had done a good job. But Matthew is really the one who did it. I mean, I put my two cents here and there, but he's the one basically who got the footage and put the movie together. And then at the end, I was just giving him like little things here and there that I wanted to change. But really, I think he did 90% of the work. But also on the set, we're also editing the movie while we're shooting it.
Okay.
Because very often you see a scene and you're thinking, okay, now we got this shot and the next one could be this way and then the other one like this. So we're sort of editing as we're shooting it because we don't have a lot of time. We took 20 days to shoot that film. So we had to work very quickly. So that really helps when you really have your story, when you've already seen your story like I have, and in your head, and then you can edit on the set. So it makes the editor's job easier, and it makes it helps us not to waste time on the set also.
And not to waste, you know, extraneous footage that you're not going to need.
Yeah, in the age, in the golden age of the DVDs, we would have had all these deleted scenes that we could have put on the DVD. But now it's video on demand. So, but you know, I keep the footage. You never know. It's put together. Maybe I'll do another cut at some point, but I don't think it'll be necessary.
I think the cut you have now is wonderful. And as you said,
thank you.
Those opening sequences, first, you know, we've got the sequences of Kim performing on stage and then her little bathroom tete-a-tete. And then we go to air traffic control, and it is, you are on tenterhooks as you're watching because we can see on the monitors what's about to happen. And you really, Matthew does a great job of building the tension incrementally, and cutting to, that's where your close-up is important. As we see Kim's face, and then as we're looking at the monitors, and we see those red lines, and they're starting to intersect, and you really are. You're just waiting. And then we get the aftermath, and we're hearing from a pilot, and it's like, and then you realize, uh-oh. And that's when everything just, that's the catalyst that just sends everything spiraling for the rest of the film. Now, I'm curious about the final act, like the final, I'd say, 5-7 minutes.
Yeah.
Was there ever a doubt in your mind to give us that final twist?
I'm sorry. Was there ever a doubt in your mind if...
Was there ever a doubt in your mind about giving us that final twist?
Yes, because we have an alternate ending that we shot.
Oh, Simon!
and it's funny because that was the next thing I wanted to mention. we have an alternate ending. And again, in the days of the DVD, there would have been an alternate ending, actually. And the alternate ending cost a lot of money to shoot. And I basically left it on the cutting room floor. It took half a day, and, you know, tens of thousands of dollars are left on the cutting room floor because we thought, and I say we because, you know, this is teamwork.
Right.
I have a lot of collaborators. We went through this as a team, and we figured that the ending that we have was the best.
Oh, I yeah. love the ending that you have. Shocked me. Did not see this ending coming. So, and I think everybody that watches the film is going to say the same thing. Your eyes yeah. are going to bug out, and your jaw's going to drop, and you're just going to go, "Oh my God."
Yeah, it's not the Sixth Sense.
No.
But it's quite surprising.
It's very surprising. But something I have to commend you on is your sound, especially in that final sequence and the sound as it goes into the end credits. The sound.
Yeah.
And I can't say what it is, but it gives you yet the sound gives you another twist.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
So it's... all these fun things. But now I have to ask you, your composer, Oliver Pallotta, it is his first film that he has scored. He's normally a keyboardist for the band Camelot. What led you to Oliver, and what were you looking for musically from a scoring standpoint?
Well, first of all, I'm a big fan of the band Camelot. And at some point, I was looking for a composer. And I saw that he offered his services for music in general, you know, film or whatever. And at first, I hired him to do the covers for the songs.
Mm-hmm.
Because the songs that we use in the films, there are three of them. They are actual songs. They were not written for the film. They are actual songs.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is from Judas Priest. The other one is from A Battle Beast. And the last one is House of the Rising Sun, which is a classic from 100 years ago, but that was done and redone and redone. So since Kim is singing in a cover band, after I got the rights to the songs, I needed a musician to basically interpret the songs. So he found a singer because the actress playing Kim is not a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And after I saw the result, and the guy's a keyboard player, he plays a lot of instruments, and I said, hey, I think you would be good at doing the score. So I sent him the film, he sent me all the music that he wrote, and I thought it was very good. So that's what happened. At first he was hired to do the covers, but then he ended up with the job of, you know, doing the score.
Wow. No, because I like the music. I like the covers that you have, but I like the music. You don't burden us. The score is not overburdening. It does not lead us.
No.
It does not tell us, ooh, get ready to be afraid. it does a really nice job of being an undercurrent. Just on every level, Simon, so well done. The thought that you put into this, telling this story, is just so evident on screen. And I'm just so impressed by the fact you had these two separate stories, you know, about a Ponzi scheme, air traffic controller, and you managed to meld them together in a very believable tale and then bring it to life with twists and turns and, you know, and the whole crime mystery thriller aspect, and then grief and how some people don't deal with it, how they do deal with it, and the fallout of what can happen. Just so well done. So well done, Simon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, and everybody can now see Charlie Tango on September 3rd digitally. And that's in North America, correct? That's not over. That's not across the pond yet, is it?
No, for now it's North America, It's going to be on the most video on demand platforms, and also anyone who has cable at home, you know, with the big the major companies,
yes,
they will be able to rent it also.
I have cable. I'm a dying breed.
Well, yeah, but there's still millions of people who have cable, so I think. You know, I think it's it was worth it putting it on cable, but also the platforms, you know, like the major ones that everyone knows. So
the usual suspects, yeah.
Yeah, the usual suspects. So, yeah, available on September 3rd. And I think people will have a good time, you know, get your favorite drink and popcorn, chips, whatever, and enjoy this 98-minute film.
I think they definitely will. Simon, this has been so wonderful having you on the show. I hope you'll come back again in the future with another project.
I hope so, too. I hope this one does well. If it does well, then we'll make another one.
That's just it. You got to have one do well to get the money for the second one.
Exactly.
Oh, Simon, thank you so, so much. And hopefully we'll talk again sooner rather than later.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks, Simon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Simon Boisvert, writer, director of Charlie Tango, September 3rd, digital, and surprise, on VOD as well. So it'll be on Spectrum, which, by the way, people have asked me this. I maintain my cable for one reason, TCM. TCM, because TCM does not have its own digital platform, and for doing things like participating in the community TCM party, tweeting during films and all, you can only do that with VOD. Some films for TCM you can find, and you know, you can watch them on YouTube, but it's not the community spirit with everybody watching at one time. So, those of you, and I know that there are many, Will McKinley, I'm talking to you, and some other of my TCM fellow TCM peeps. Yeah, we won't give up our TCM. So it means cable has a captive audience with some of us. All right, now, we are going to go back to my exclusive interview with John Keyes on the cleanup crew, and Pam faded it out before you could hear my full question and comment, but talking about the score. So let's pick up there as John starts talking about the music in the film, the composers, the needle drops. Take a listen.
Fun.
Right.
Instrumentation pops with some really unique instrumentation happening. What were you looking for musically to complement the insanity that was going on?
I knew from the get-go I wanted something with a rock and roll vibe and a rock and roll tune. And I had collected a whole lot of songs that sort of just had a vibe and a rhythm and a tone that I thought, you know, it drove the action through the rock and roll, but it also had a whimsical nature. So they never forgot about the comedy. And Aoife and Jerry, who are the composers, I've worked with them, and I've known them for 20 years. And they're these two just incredibly gifted, talented, versatile musicians. They kind of play anything and can write anything. And they were there. They actually lived in Dublin. So we were able to spend a lot of time together in person, and they spent a lot of time on set. And Jerry would have the music, and he'd like be listening to it on a headset while I'm filming a scene, and then he'd go home and he and Aoife would start writing little pieces of music for us to listen to and for me to listen to. So we knew it was going to be rock and roll with a bit of a comedic vibe, but then I really wanted them to just run with their own creativity and run with their own ideas. And so I was getting new music every single day.
Oh my God.
That helped them help them, you know, hear how it was going to be once they actually started writing the score. And I haven't been able to experience that before. So having them there with us the whole time organically made it, you know, honestly really easy at that point. Because by the time we had the movie shot, they knew what the score was going to be.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience being able to do it that way.
Wow. And that really lets you marry all the pieces together in an expeditious fashion.
Exactly. Absolutely. And what made it fun, one of the things that I told Jerry and Eva at the beginning with the music is, I mean, you know, particularly with horror movies and thrillers and stuff, we know that the music is always informing the audience of how they should be feeling. Whereas this, we knew from the beginning, all three of us had decided we didn't want to necessarily do that with this music. We wanted the music to simply be complimenting everything that's happened rather than trying to inform an audience of how they should feel.
On every level, you knock it out of the park here, John.
Really appreciate that.
And of course, I really love the Easter egg that you give us, and all I'm going to say about it is the blue VW Beetle.
I won't give it away either, but that gag we literally came up with on the spot. We just had this moment where it jumped into my head, and I'm like, I don't know if I'll ever use it, but let's do it.
Absolutely fantastic on every single level, John. This movie is just so much fun. So much fun.
Well, I appreciate that. I really think that I've had a lot of feedback as I was putting the movie together, a lot of feedback since this has been done, and I feel really good about audiences being able to sit back, you know, on a Friday night and pop this movie in and just have a lot of fun for an hour and a half.
I have so much fun watching it. I'm definitely going to be watching it again. Because it's the kind of movie you can pop it in and just sit there and have a good time. You don't have to analyze anything. You don't have to look for a hidden agenda. The agenda here is having fun.
Exactly, exactly. Entertain, entertain, entertain.
Don't ever question yourself on doing comedy, John.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
As much as I love what you produce and direct, from an action standpoint, from a thriller standpoint, you really don't ever doubt your ability with comedy, because you did a great job with the cleanup crew and marrying comedy and action together. You're going to clean up on this one. Let me just put it that way.
I like that. I will take that.
Oh. John, this has been so fabulous to get to speak with you about the cleanup crew and touch on some of these other films that you've been involved with. I cannot wait to see what you give me next. I want more.
I can't wait. Thank you for that. I've got some really fun ones up my sleeve.
John, thank you, thank you, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Well, thank you for everything. I appreciate everything that you said.
And I hope we get to do this again in the future.
100%. Let's do it.
All right. Well, you go have yourself a great rest of the week that's almost done, and a fun-filled weekend.
Thanks. You too. Enjoy.
Thanks, John. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
And that was the conclusion of my interview with director John Keyes, talking about the oh-so-fun, the cleanup crew on VOD, on digital, right now. Do yourself a favor. You got a holiday weekend coming up. You just want to kick back and not do anything. Sit there at night, like John said, you know, get a drink, have some popcorn, watch the movie, and have some fun. Now, we won't be here next Monday because Pam is not going to be laboring on Labor Day. I will be laboring, just not here at the studio. But we will be back with more Behind the Lens on Monday, the 9th of September, when Anna Elizabeth James joins us to talk about her new film, her new Lifetime film, Held Hostage in My House. So, I haven't watched that one yet. I will be doing that over the weekend, I am sure. But until September 9th, a lot of great movies out there for you to watch this coming weekend over the holiday. You Gotta Believe, The Thicket, Reagan. You know, take your pick. And don't forget, My Penguin Friend is still out there in theaters. And that is the most heartwarming, sweet, wonderful movie of the year for my money. So, until September 9th, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.